And our special guest tonight, Linda Moulton Howe, and it's called Conversations with Linda. We take your phone calls with her, and if you want to share some stories with us, you can do that too. So we'll do that when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to our final hour with Linda Moulton Howe. We call it Conversations with Linda. Linda, your works, your books and DVDs, they're still available to people, aren't they?
They're always available. The very first book goes back to 1989. It has never been out of print. It's been through many, many, many printings. And the reason why I don't distribute through Amazon.com is that there was a period of time when Amazon.com was extremely unfair to people who were dealing with them. And I decided that I would just distribute my books and documentaries and DVDs through earthfiles.com in the shop. It has worked out very well. And so for people listening, I have four books and three documentaries, and I'm going to be doing a new series of some of my best long, real X-Files that are going to be in special downloads and DVDs, and all of this is at the earthfiles.com shop. You go to earthfiles.com, and on the left there is a column, and you just click on the shop, and my books and the DVDs are always there. And the four books, An Alien Harvest, Glimpses of Other Realities, Volume 1 and 2, and Mysterious Lights and Crop Circles, are in many ways, I am referencing my own work now all the time because new information is beginning to come forward that is strengthening and reinforcing the validity of things that I have been exposed to over the last 36 years and that are in those four books. And I find it I'm awestruck by the way the focus is coming into play in 2016 on subjects in ways that just seem to resonate and echo from everything I was trying to deal with long ago in animal mutilations, human abductions, government knowledge, cover-up, crop formations, all of it. And it's so interesting that I think you and I and a bunch of us are going to be at Contact in the Desert.
Oh, yes, that's right. Don't forget, it's my birthday party, too.
Oh, yeah. Well, happy birthday then, and hopefully we'll all be able to celebrate with you together.
That'll be fun.
And it's 3 to 6 in June, the 3rd to the 6th, and what they have under my name is The Reality of Crop Formations, Non-Humans, Animal Mutilations, Military Underground, and Government Black Budget Projects. And that really is sort of a sum up of all the categories. And I know that in the lectures and the workshops that I'm doing, that I have been getting reactions from audiences that are so huge now. And I think part of it is that people in this age of being mad at the government and expressing their anger, that people really, really are beginning to stand up for their own experiences, like this man that I just had on in the fourth half hour. He still is not prepared to come forward with his real name or where he really lives, but he is telling a story that he has never told before, and look at how many ways it winds and braids into the history of 1996, and every time more people are coming forward, it is, I think it's encouraging so many other people. And then for an investigative reporter like me to be able to interface, I think Paul and Vicky say that we could have as many as 2,000, 2,500 people at Contact in the Desert.
Oh, they had a couple thousand last year.
Yeah. And so that is a step in the right direction, and I'm encouraging anybody at Earth Files and Coast to Coast to go to Contact in the Desert, because it is really one of the most energetic and substantive-packed conferences in the world, I would say, and that this is the time to start interfacing with the fact that there are breakthroughs now happening in the RAF Bentwaters phenomena, that there are hugely I think, important breakthroughs having to do with high strangeness in both human abductions and animal mutilations, which are beginning to shed more light. I'm working on amazing things having to do with symbols and binary code that have been occurring not just in Jim Peniston, but in many other people, and that we're beginning to see patterns of communication. And recently, talking with one of the geneticists, he's helped in Arieth Bentwaters with the Peniston binary, and he's been helping me on another case. And he thinks that we are dealing with a binary code download telepathically that could be so complex that within the shading of, meaning if you have squares and ones, and some of the squares are clear and some of the squares are shaded black, and you you take it all, you take the shaded, you get one code. You take the clear, you get one code. You take the clear and the shaded, you get a third code. And we're working on that right now. And he says he's not aware that there is any human system on Earth that would be embedding three communications in three different layers of binary code.
And Linda, in your entire career, what would you say if people said, you know, this Linda Moulton Howe, she, what was it, crop formations? What do you think your forte would be?
Well, I got into all of this through animal mutilations, and I think I have done the most work there in terms of forensic science,
right,
and working with people. But that led strongly to the abductions, which led strongly to government policies of denial and cover-up and manipulation and intimidation. And then came the crop formations on their own in 1989. At least the world woke up to them in 1989 and 90. So that was right at the cusp of my having done all the animal mutilation work and the abduction work, and did my first book, An Alien Harvest, came out in 89. And here came crop formations. And so in that decade of the 90s, I went to England in the summers 7 or 8 times, had some of the most extraordinary experiences of my life. And I have now 3 times in England, I have personally seen the strange glowing orbs. I have seen at night on the top of Woodborough Hill. I have seen, they call them pumpkin orange lights. They're very unique in color, moving in and out of the trees on top of Woodborough Hill. I have seen a white, looking exactly like a mirror flashing, but moving up along the tops of wheat in another field. And then there is that famous time I was on in one of the red telephone booths connected to Art Bell, and we walked literally from a soggy east field for me to do coast to coast through that red telephone booth with 6 or 7 other witnesses who were with me that night. So we filled the coast to coast with all of these live action stories that we had a military, this is before 9/11, and so I was able to get a military-grade infrared scope into England that year, and this would have been 2000. And so it had been a huge thunderstorm, and there had been helicopters all over the East Field that day. We all knew that. That's why we were focused on it. We thought, what in the world are all of those helicopters, military, doing over the East Field? We've got to go there, even if there was a thunderstorm. And we found that all of the roads around that field, George, they had been flooded. In some cases, there were 2 or 3 feet of water. You couldn't take a car into some of those roads that night. So we knew all of the boundary of the East Field. We knew what we were looking at through the scope, that we could go star scope, infrared, and so forth. And to our eyes, the field was as black coal, and the sky was clouded. There were no stars. And yet when I picked up that military-grade telescope that could look in infrared, and I'm looking out onto the field, suddenly, the first thing that popped in, and it popped in like it didn't fly in, it just popped in. It was bright, an oval, and the oval began to move, and I couldn't believe it. And I handed the scope to the other people with me, and all of us now for the next 90 minutes, we were watching an oval light inside of this infrared popping back and forth, moving. One of the guys started yelling out over the field. You couldn't see anything with the human eye. Got to remember this. All of this bright action and motion was happening in a different frequency. But he started yelling, look, we're not afraid. We're not afraid. Come, we want to see you close. And the truth is, every single one of us saw the reaction, because we all kept passing the scope around. As people yelled, this thing went from an oval into a pattern of a perfect square that seemed to flutter and pulse in the scope, reacting to our yelling out into the field. And this went on as for over an hour, changing shape, jumping. And when it got to about 90 minutes, an hour and a half of this, well, all these people constantly seeing all of this happening, all of a sudden, I just happened to be the person who was holding the scope when it did like a transformation between the square and the oval, the square and the oval, like saying goodbye or something. And then, bang, it just popped out, it like when people say a light switch. Well, that was one of the most extraordinary experiences. I and the others said the same thing. We were all being able to be a reality check on what everybody was watching. And there was something out in that field that was soggy wet. The roads were filled with water. And yet it was able to put on some sort of a communication performance with a group of us. And when you hear the people who are the so-called professionally paid debunkers say that there is nothing to the crop formations except Doug and Dave. It is so repellent to those of us who have had an experience like what I've just described, when Doug and Dave had only had boards and string in Somerset and a couple in Wiltshire, and they never were responsible for anything around the world. And in fact, the September of 1990 was the year that they came forward with one of the fringe video places and stood and said, we're responsible, we're responsible. And we all knew that was not true. And you know, George, what put that lie, that paid shill over the top was the fact that news media like the New York Times carried the story on page 2 above the fold. I saw it with my own eyes. I still have it in a file somewhere. Crop formation mystery solved. Two gentlemen, I think is the way the Times put it, in Somerset. Well, it was preposterous. It meant that the New York Times had not done one single piece of independent investigation, because if they had done so, they would have known that that summer there were crop formations quite complex in 23 countries around the planet, including in rice paddies in Japan. Those photographs were astounding. And Doug and Dave and nobody in Wiltshire or Somerset were responsible for all of those crop formations in those 23 countries. And to this day, I'm very interested in this year of 2016, as complicated as the world is, as dangerous as and precarious feeling as it does now, and with people in the abduction syndrome saying, Linda, something's happening. Something big is going to open up. What will come down in crop formations, not just England, but last year, I think the most extraordinary crop formation perhaps of all time, except for Windmill Hill of the multiple arms back in 1996. It was Italy. It was near Turin, the Shroud of Turin, you've heard.
Mm-hmm.
This was a pattern so complicated that I have had dialogues through email and letters with people who have been trying to crack the binary code that they know is in this amazing pattern. And is there a reason why in the summer of 2015 that this huge, gigantic, complex, it is so detailed and complex, no human could even have begun to make it in its intricacy. But when people are studying it in terms of binary code, we already have gotten some of the binary code and its warning, just like all the other warnings over the last three decades that have come when we've had binary code. And there is this sense, why was it near the town where the shroud of Jesus Christ is the burial shroud, or alleged burial shroud, hangs in the Cathedral of Turin?
That story all by itself is one of the best ever.
Absolutely. And there was a series that I did at Earth Files and on Coast to Coast long ago, back around 1995, and that was an interview that I did with he was a chemist, and he had done a presentation at an electrical engineering meeting in, I think it was in Missouri, and his hypothesis in the paper that he presented, which is why I interviewed him and had him on Coast, was that he wanted to duplicate the oil, the linen, everything to a T that they knew that was on the Shroud of Turin, and he put it over a low-energy X-ray. And George, when they took that linen and they took it off the low-energy X-ray, the fibrils in the upper 100th of an inch of that linen matched exactly where the discoloration is on the real Shroud of Turin in the cathedral, which is where the big crop formation was this past summer.
Yeah. Did you ever interview Barry Schwartz, who was the official photographer? He's a believer that it's authentic. That is an amazing story.
Well, yeah, and for some reason, I don't know what's happening now with your audio, but you're coming up for two words and then it's fading out.
Huh.
I don't know. It's like a wave. Oh. Now I can hear you back again. But you're asking me about Barry Schwartz. And I know that there are people who worked in the... Remember, there was a JPL investigation.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, hold on, Linda. We'll talk about this, and we'll take all the calls from people who are lining up right here on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We sent out a couple more tweets tonight. I hope you got them. If you didn't, sign up and go get them again. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe with us, and we're going to get to all your questions when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget our Friday night show, of course. We're going to dabble with the paranormal and those special open lines. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Linda's with us and your calls, and let's hit them right away. Oh, Linda, let's wrap up about the shroud real quickly,
yeah. And
then we'll go to the folks that are on hold.
This was such extraordinary work because it was presented in a formal paper at a formal conference, and in the interview, he was going through the fact that he was convinced that it was X-ray radiation or some frequency in that realm that would have gone and excited the body that was underneath the shroud. And then you jump over to the issue of some people in the government saying that they have knowledge about how this played out and that there was some sort of a beam and all of that. But even if you don't go there, it's the idea of something extraordinary at a frequency, a high frequency like an X-ray, that would have excited the X-ray would have excited the material and left that tiny residue of the brownness that makes the pattern. It's only in the 1/100th of the fibril of the linen, and that was always something very extraordinary when JPL and others had examined it, and they realized this was not something like a quote-unquote stain down woven into the fabric. This is a coloration change that is only in the 1/100th of an inch fibril on the top, and it was the X-ray that did that, and that is what he reported. And then the question was, what would generate an X-ray high frequency inside of a cave of a man who had died, and then he disappeared?
Yeah. All right, to the phones now we go. Gordon in Lakeland, Florida, to get us started. Go ahead, Gordon.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, George and Linda.
You're welcome.
First off, the green stain or mark on the carpet, I want to find out if you know if that man ever got it tested, or if not, why. And secondly, thank you for standing up for the environment. I appreciate that, but I have some concerns. I studied the CO2 phenomenon, and the CO2 levels went up and down a long time before even technology got, and we think, there, scientists are disagreeing, we think that the CO2 levels didn't cause the temperature, but rather the temperature caused the CO2 levels, although there, I will admit, there's some disagreement on that, and I wanted your take on both of those issues, if you could.
I'll start with CO2. The big anomaly right now from the 20th to the 21st century is the rapidity. In the past, when people say, well, the dinosaurs lived and it was 1,000 parts per million, that may be true. But when you go back into the record on this planet, whether they're doing it with ice or tree cores or whatever it is, everything had gradual buildups and coming down. And what we have managed to do as an industrial civilization just since the 20th century is that we have accelerated the rise of carbon dioxide and methane that could have taken, let's say, much longer over centuries, and everything would have adapted to it over a long period of time. But the warming is happening rapidly because the volume is happening rapidly. And the warming is happening at such a rate, as you can almost read in any subject now, the problems with marine life surviving, birds surviving, so many things are just having one heck of a time. Because what once upon a time were predictable and dependable seasons, and that meant that certain things would grow in one geographic place and animals would always come back there for their food. And now that's changing all over the planet. It's changing rapidly. It's changing more rapidly than plants can keep up and lots of earth life. And that is the key to this whole question of what is happening and why is it so serious. It's the rapidity. Now, on the issue on the stain on the floor, I asked him and had hoped that he still had the carpet, because boy, would I have liked to get that into a lab. But his answer was no, and they never did test it. And I have found this. I know it seems upside down and bass-ackwards, but I think it is part of the human psyche. When things occur that are outside of, way far outside of what is considered to be a normal paradigm, people are so bothered. They don't want it around. They want everything that happened in a room, anything that's associated with spills or anything, they want it out. And in some ways, I really understand and I have sympathy, but if there are people listening who may end up having interactions with beings or they have something strange happen, please get in touch with me. It is through physical examinations in labs where I've had my strongest evidence in the crop formations and animal mutilations. Those are two areas where we have a lot of forensic science. And it always helps, even though I am convinced there is an alien presence. The bigger question now is, where did the alien presence, did it come from? Has it always been here? Is it always underneath the Earth? And what exactly is the relationship between the alien presence and the surface life? And we humans are a surface life on this planet. And it is part of this century, I think, that we are redefining everything that the human family is in relationship to the planet, to the cosmos, and to something that seems to have a big grasp on what we are and always is keeping itself in the shadows and invisible while we are tested, monitored, and manipulated. I think that when John Keel wrote that book, The Haunted Planet, Our Haunted Planet, that was the title. I think that was one of the best titles of all time, Our Haunted Planet. It is haunted because we are a surface life that has evolved in the presence of something else that never seems to want us to be able to have a direct relationship with it.
Next up, Gina in Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Gina, go ahead.
Oh, hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure, you're very welcome.
My topic is reincarnation,
uh-huh.
And your comments before that, Rudolf Steiner saying that we're all volunteers, but we don't remember. Well, I do. And I also wanted to say something about David Bowie, but first, let's talk about me. I do remember, I have a very strong conscious, even visual memory of the conversation of being asked to come back. It was like a misty white, and there was like a grandfatherly figure and his assistant, and they asked me, they said, we'd like you to come back, it's your choice, and we want to show you what, you can expect, to happen. And I just immediately said, no, you don't speak further, I will go. If it's important enough for you to ask me to go, I will go. And they said, well, wait, but you still have to look. We still want to show you this. And I don't remember what they showed me, but in the first couple of years of my life, I have a very, very strong memory of, I guess you would say, astral traveling back and forth to visit.
Well, look, there's no question that, in my mind, Linda, reincarnation is the real deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and to follow up, thank you to the...
We won't have time for your David Bowie question because we've got too many callers and not enough time. So
I was just going to say that one of the most important reinforcements of reincarnation came to me through a man who was dying. He had been the Air Force captain who had spent time at Los Alamos with one of the beings that they had retrieved. And the captain could understand the telepathic downloads of the extraterrestrial biological entity, and others could not. And one of his statements before he died was, in answer to a question, is reincarnation real? He answered in the context of what the Eben had told him. Yes, reincarnation, the recycling of souls, is the machinery of this universe. And I do think it is the fundamental key, and that we shouldn't be so Kardashianized and focused on bodies and matter. We should be concentrating on developing and evolving that part of us that is the pura vida, and that is that life force that animates the body. At death, that's what leaves.
Jerry's in Santa Fe, Texas now. Hi, Jerry. It's your turn.
Well, hello, George. Great show you have.
Thank
I'm a first-time caller. I really, really enjoy listening to you.
Good to have you.
My reason why I'm calling is I'm familiar with the Kastner Glacier area. I've hiked it. And the guy that was telling the story about the Black Sphinx, or hearing the story about the Black Sphinx, did you ever try to interview any bush pilots that may have been flying around the area. You know, that time of year, there's always, it seems like, always put a plane in the air. Every hour, every other hour, you're hearing them. And it just, it seems to me like, you know, that would be something that would be seen, obviously, by a pilot up there. And I was just wondering if there had been any reports, maybe, of the Black Sphinx, other than...
Well, the Sphinx is not, we haven't put a color on that. The dark, the word dark,
dark.
Went to the Dark Pyramid. The stories that I was reporting with whistleblowers in 2012, what is so interesting is that within 120 miles as the crow flies on the ridge of that Alaska range, that we would have a series of people talking about a dark pyramid. That is a word that was used for a reason having to do with it being deep underground. And that was in front of Mount Denali, going to the west 60 miles. And now here comes Jared Beeler with his story from the Sarda Borealis of a sphinx. We don't know characteristics beyond, he said, that it was similar in size. Get this. Similar in size to the Sphinx in Giza. And the question of where could it be, and that there was some sort of a military unit that had surrounded it for some period of time, and this was back, he thought, in 2004, 2003. The glaciers up there, as you know, if you go to my Earth Files report and you look at the glaciers, and I've been also looking at Google Earth, that you will find that up on some of those ridges, it's absolutely snowless. And the Sphinx, according to Jared, at the time that they were looking at it, was not, he didn't think, was in snow, but that it had been, or it had been covered because it had just emerged. So your suggestion is part of the reason I so much wanted to do this story tonight on Coast, whether it's pilots, military, intel, anybody out there who may have the way to look over the Tassner Glacier or who has had experiences there and could let me know, we would sure, Jared Beeler and others and I would sure like to be able to follow up. I can say I talked with another one of the men in each group and completely confirmed the discussion, being there, hearing about the Sphinx, and how nobody could believe that a Sphinx like Giza could be up somewhere in 4 days from Black Rapids up on Castor Glacier. It's incredible, but the idea that a Sphinx and a pyramid would be together on this planet, if in fact the planet has been terraformed by an alien presence that knows what it's doing with something that we don't have a clue, that's what intrigues me about the juxtaposition of these two up there in Alaska.
What great stories on this planet, Linda. Just great stories.
Yeah, well, it's an amazing, amazing universe, an amazing planet, and I can't think of anything that I would rather do than keep exploring the mysteries and trying to report the facts.
Sean is in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Hey, Sean, good morning to you.
Hey, George, Linda, thank you all for taking the call. I'll try to be as efficient with this as I can.
Okay.
When I was in eighth grade, 1988, a friend and I, we snuck out on his motorcycle. This was in Gwinnett County, Georgia, and we went down Five Forks Trickum Road, right where Ronald Reagan Parkway is now. Before that was there, his girlfriend had a house there. It was a long dirt road to an old cabin. They had a note to say, you got to move out in 5 years. We're wrecking it to build this road. So he goes up there to see her, and I'm sitting at the end of this driveway in the woods, probably 30 or 40 feet off the two-lane blacktop road, just sitting on his motorcycle, and I hear this, it's three in the morning, I hear this oscillating sound, just this oscillating, just all in the air, all around, and I stand up, and I'm looking up in the trees towards it, and it's just just woo, just oscillating like you couldn't believe. And sometime later, I'm probably 150, 100 feet over, face down on my knees and hands, and I feel like I'm in a net of some sort. But, you know, I'm on the ground in the leaves. And
so there was missing time. There was missing time between the sound and you discovering yourself on the ground in leaves?
Probably most of the time. We've got a minute left here.
Yeah, can you email me at earthfiles@earthfiles.com so that I can talk with you about this story more in depth?
I would love to. I'll absolutely do that.
Super,
oh,
super.
Do.
Linda, as we wrap things up, where do you go next? I guess I'll see you in Joshua Tree.
Well, yes, and before that, I'm going to be up in Dulce at the conference there. There's going to be a very interesting group of us about the strange history of North that part of New Mexico in relationship to, are there or is there evidence of an underground alien presence in Dulce, in Area 51, in Rachel, in the Himalayas around the world?
Something could be happening there indeed. Hey, Linda, thanks again. We'll see you also next month for another series of great reports. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.